basically,
conference record
report.
Has joined the conference.
The children's subcommittee that Gail has been chairing, we Linda and I explicitly commissioned. The other two were things that came at us where we realized we hadn't done enough to prepare. And Ellen, who I think had a doctor thing come up today and is not going to be here, had made some recommendations to us about the flavor of peer services that should be reflected in our report. She's passed those to Harvey, who I think is going to represent them. And then also, there's been a informal MRT group without the full status of a subcommittee that has made some recommendations on peer stuff. And so Harvey is advancing those, even though they extend beyond the behavioral health arena, right, Harvey, across
correct.
The whole Medicaid program?
Correct.
So we have a second subcommittee there. And just last week or 2 weeks ago, Ann Sullivan realized that we hadn't said anything. I mean, you know, sort of we're tethered to the MRT mothership, which means Medicaid, but there's more than Medicaid in the system. And in particular, challenges related to people that don't have insurance. And so Ann, having raised the issue, got volunteered to lead a conversation about that involving some members. And so she'll bring that forward to us as well. I think my hope is that through presentation and conversation about each of those things, the recommendations that have come from each of those groups can and will be accepted by our group here today for inclusion in the final report. And then we want to spend more time going in a slightly more detailed fashion through the final report, and we've got, I don't know whether people even have it yet. Do we send it out, Rebecca?
We send it out, yeah.
But the final report draft, we have paper copies of that? Okay.
We've just seen an outline. We haven't seen any.
Well, everybody's been like working eight times, or you know, eight different jobs. So Andy and Bob and staff have been working to take this from outline to a paper copy. So we'll have a paper copy before you, and I think Andy is also prepared to put it up on the screen. And I think we know that there's going to have to be considerable editing to finish this out, but what we want to focus on is unpacking the recommendations. And I think what we'll do is we're not going to try to do group editing because that would be torturous. But what we will do is spend some time on each section of the recommendations. And I would like to get to a place where we have, you know, comfort level and consensus about the substance of those recommendations today that is sufficient for people to be able to translate that into a final written product. So we'll take, you know, whatever time we need to take to have that conversation, but I think we're prepared enough, we've talked enough about recommendations already, so that, I shouldn't say this because it'll botch it for sure, but I'm a little bit optimistic that we might get done on time or maybe even a little bit early, but we'll see how that goes. Is there anything else framing, Linda, that you want to add?
I guess the thing I would add is that I think that the recommendations are all really strong, incredibly well thought out. People put just a ton of effort into all of this, members of this group, the staff working with all of us, and I feel like we're on a path to give the governor's office some really strong recommendations. Thank you.
I do too. So with that, let's launch. And Gail, I can't believe you actually got done with this in a month and have stuff for us, but you do.
If you're not on, just talk closer to the mic.
On. Okay, sorry. Because I've never been accused of having a soft voice by you. So there were 22 people who worked on this series of recommendations. We had five meetings, including a conference call last week. All of our meetings were open to the public. We took
questions and content from everyone, and we uploaded everything onto the MRT website. So the Medicaid Redesign Team Behavioral Health Work Group, which is all of us, convened a small group of broadly representative mental health, substance use disorder providers, families, youth, and government representatives. The goal was to really make specific recommendations within the larger BHO subcommittee report around child-specific mental health and substance use and abuse services. As I said, we had five meetings between July 28th and September 8th. And while our charge related specifically to children with Medicaid and their families, we actually thought it was essential to take a look at the research experience and collective children's context and develop some universal statements for children and their families in general as it relates to behavioral health, with the expectation that there would be in New York State sort of a set of core expectations for all payers regardless of whether they were Medicaid payers or commercial payers generally. There are sort of four big conclusions that I'm going to start with, and then I'm going to talk in more detail about. One is that obviously intervening early in the progression of behavioral health disorders is effective and it reduces costs. We are not taking on taking for granted or assuming that people on the Medicaid redesign team or on the second floor actually understand children's behavioral health care needs. So we wanted to make sure that we articulated the things that we take as core values and understandings of the way the system works and doesn't work, which accounts for the fact that if you intervene early, it actually produces a better result and it reduces cost. We want accountability across payers. We wanted to expressly talk about the fact that children, child and family services in New York are siloed, and that creates certain kinds of complications as it relates to behavioral health. And we need to deal with those explicitly. And then finally, that the current behavioral health care system for children and their families is grossly underfunded. So we came up with some building blocks that to create an operating framework. We're looking at behavioral health and health in relation to the child's ability to function at home, in school, and in the community, and that these capacities have to be supported and enhanced for every child. We talked a lot about healthy development, basically as a multi-path and very dynamic process, and the need to assess children's social, cultural, linguistic, and learning needs that also have to be integrated into all efforts to promote and restore healthy development. We are very supportive of the notion of peer and family support, self-help, and natural supports that have to be integrated with other behavioral health services to empower children and their families to offer choice and approach to care and reduce reliance on formal systems of care. The building blocks are kind of as follows. These are really core principles: that effective behavioral health services have to be available and accessible to children where and when they are needed. They have to be responsive, timely, and adapt to complex and changing needs and evolving situations. Childhood is not static. We want intervention at the earliest possible juncture, and we would like health and behavioral health services provided through the perspective that's informed about childhood trauma, child and adolescent development, family life, and obviously the providers need to be adept at supporting, providing services to this population. We want our outcomes to be clearly articulated, measured, reported, and used to inform policy, services reimbursement, and practice quality. We want accountability mechanisms that focus on achieving specific child outcomes. We want accountability to occur at the behavioral health provider level and across the relevant child-serving systems, because behavioral health outcomes for children are often achieved by services that extend beyond the behavioral health care system. We would like outcome data to be linked to performance incentives, and we want the outcome measures to be reported at the child provider system and population level. We go on and talk a lot about efficiencies that can be achieved by ensuring that services and case planning is integrated and coordinated. We would like to see the current regulatory process management requirements replaced by a systems-oriented one where there's accountability for outcomes. and we want to protect and preserve the continuity of the child's care and relationship with primary care and behavioral health providers, regardless of their health insurance coverage and their plan. We talk about technology and financing mechanisms that incentivize clinical outcomes and coordinated case planning. We expect that the entities that receive behavioral health financing will exercise the highest degree of fiscal integrity, transparent reporting, and quality practice to create a high-performing, high-quality system of care. I've already said that children's behavioral health services are grossly underfunded, and they are not available in an even distribution, and we'll talk about that. But we do specifically say that there should be investments in early identification and effective interventions for children because they yield short and long-term savings for government as well as improvement in the lives of children. And we would like a commitment that will return savings generated from Medicaid-managed care arrangements associated with children for use in developing additional behavioral health services, supports, and clinical capacity in the community. We believe that managed care arrangements have to support providers as they maintain compliance with statutory, court-ordered, and or public obligations for child safety, public safety, and access to appropriate education and primary and preventive health care, not substitute for those. We made three basic recommendations. One were the core elements of the benefit package and priorities for basic Medicaid managed care, Child Health Plus, Family Health Plus, and commercial insurance plans. The second were enhanced elements of a benefit package and processes for specialty behavioral health care managed care plans for kids with special needs. And our third recommendation was around outcome measurement and standards to review and incentivize program performance and ensure that there is regular public reporting of those outcomes. We looked at in the first and second recommendation around basic benefits and specialty benefits. We assessed on a number of dimensions, six of them. We looked at access, medical necessity, basic behavioral health benefit, provider network, fiscal, and outcomes. In keeping with the template that we got from the MRT, we also took a shot at benefits and concerns. We did not calculate financial impact because we just didn't get there, but we would if we could. In recommendation number two, which is around children with serious emotional disturbance and substance abuse disorders who also have complex symptoms and behaviors, that they would be served in a specialty behavioral health managed care plan for children. I want to talk a little bit about who the covered population is because we made a significant recommendation here. But basically, the specialty managed care program, which we stopped calling the BHO because we got very confused because everybody kept thinking they knew what a BHO was, but none of us agreed on what that was. So now we just call it a specialty managed care program, that we want it to be designed for children who are eligible for Medicaid, who meet defined clinical criteria, which would be a DSM diagnosis of SED or SUD, or who display complex symptoms and behaviors and who meet a risk assessment threshold. That's the sort of more general kind of typical approach. We added a provision for children who meet the clinical criteria and who also have an IEP, Individualized Education Plan, or are served in the child welfare or juvenile justice systems, and these children would have presumptive eligibility. So that's a significant change from what exists now. That's sort of the biggest change there. In terms of the outcomes, obviously the outcomes have to be specific and relevant to children. It's the piece of the system now that exists in managed care that is least developed. We like the outcomes. We did some operational definitions of outcomes such that they would be meaningful, easy to measure, validated, readily available, kind of in the public domain, off the shelf, and you don't have to buy them, and easy to use. And if you look at the behavioral health outcomes, you'll see that we want all of the children's behavioral health plans to report on child-specific outcome measures in HEDIS, CAR, and CAHPS, CAPS. The measures would look at access, network adequacy, cross-system communication, and case planning. Bear with me for a minute. medication management, success or failure at transition to less intensive levels of care, critical incidents, consumer satisfaction and involvement, improvement in functional status, and improvement in psychiatric symptoms for which treatment is sought. We worked very hard to try to come up with very specific ways to do that. The last three, network adequacy, cross-system communication, and case planning are a little bit harder to measure, but we took a shot at that. And access was 30 minutes, 30 miles. We just set a kind of physical threshold. We also believe that the public has to have regular performance data from the BHO plan. We had a tremendous amount of discussion on really all of these recommendations. We, as I said, we tried very hard to kind of put it into the MRT format. It wasn't so easy. But I think we did really a terrific job, ably assisted by Kristen Riley and Steve Hansen, who were just really wonderful. We're just wonderful as a brain trust and as incredibly credible staff. And I think, you know, the biggest issues for us really have to do with making sure that we have coverage for populations who are now not covered well, that we have geographic distribution of services and sufficient resources to actually begin to make a dent in the need for care for kids who have specialty behavioral health care needs. And so I would love to, you know, open up the floor for discussion or questions if people have them. And I want to just tell you, because I want to just be as clear as possible, that we're hoping that you all will give us a thumbs up or a thumbs down, or a we need clarification so that we can meet our deadline. Right now, yeah, exactly. I've been accused of being somewhat of a harsh taskmaster, but we're all still talking to each other. So
I'd say, Gail, this is very impressive. Because the recommendations are deep, but they're all very well grounded. And you know, they work within the framework of the system we have right now. Just for example, your recommendation about sort of raising the bar with respect to the children that are in, you know, mainstream plan arrangements makes sense. We know that, you know, that issues are missed there. And your recommendation about that presumptive eligibility. It sounds revolutionary, but it's very straightforward. This is to take into account kids that have already been labeled and in many cases have got an adverse status in another system related to their behavioral health problem. You still have to see that there's a clinical issue there, obviously. But so it sounds revolutionary, but it's really, I think it's conservative and well operationalized. The work that you've done on the outcome measures, I think, is what really ought to sell us to anybody else, because it's very, it's not complete, but it's very solid. Anyway, those are just my comments.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Do you want to just manage the conversation here?
Sure, Pam.
So I think I agree completely with Mike, and I think that a lot of what you accomplished really ought to be the sort of mantra for all the categorical mental health programs, because we all want the same things, of course, for the people who we're serving, even though there's no question that kids are not little adults.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems to me that some of the language and framework is equally applicable in the overall report. And then there are the things that might have special resonance because it's children's services, and then there are the issues that are specifically related to children, concrete, you know, really finite kinds of things. And so I'm wondering if in some way that can't be sort of teased apart so that we adopt some of what's in here for everybody, and sort of leave in the children's section the things that relate specifically to children. I thought it was great.
Thank you.
If I can just make a comment on that, I think you're onto something, Pam, there. And we'll you know, so I think, you know, I don't see anybody disagreeing with that. So we'll take that to heart with respect to editing. I'll just mention one a concrete example of that in the adult arena that we've talked a little bit about, and then we're going to be a little bit more focused on it in the report and in our follow-up work, and that has to do with the necessity of our taking a fresh and a different look at intervening with people who might be of college age or in their early 20s who have a first episode of psychosis. That is going to have to be discerned in their mainstream health plan, right? Or it may be discerned when they get admitted. But then, as opposed to sort of a system now that provides, sort of chronic episodic care, that what we know from experience in other countries, and I talked about this a little bit in one of those presentations, is that we need to sort of jump on those people, stay with them, and give them team-based care that looks a lot like care in the kids' system. It's sort of a wraparound approach to. So I'm just going off on that one detail. But your underlying point about distinguishing better and arriving at a better balance of the mainstream system and the specialty system is very well done here, and I think we should try to emulate that in the adult.
So that we would only really say, we would only have to make reference once to all the broader things. And maybe even the issue of presumptive Medicaid eligibility, which is a recurring theme, obviously, might be done once, but with different categories. I don't want to tell you how to write. So.
I'm just going to go differently. I have two questions.
Okay. First, in terms of the silos, and particularly the early intervention at the school level, a school collaboration, did you talk about that at all?
Yeah, actually, I wasn't really specific in where we thought that services should be provided, but if you look at the benefit, at the package of benefits, we say school-based schooling, and then we also talk about a whole range of outpatient clinical services, including day treatment and so forth and so on. So it's all pretty explicit in there.
Yeah, good, because, I mean, I think to the point about early intervention and early identification, the place where we learn about kids mostly is at the school. Okay, and the second question I have is about children in foster care. What are you saying there?
What we're saying basically is that if kids have a clinical need or a set of complex symptoms and behaviors, and they have either an IEP, child welfare involvement,
right,
juvenile justice involvement, they would automatically be eligible.
I got that, but then what
and
would
so
the method of service delivery, would they be in some sort of managed care? What's your?
They would go into the specialty plan, but
okay,
they would not have to apply separately. They would basically, it would be an assumption that they would have needs that had to be met by the BHO.
This is an issue which I don't want to take too much time because it maybe veers off, but it's extremely complex, having to do with the fact that, number one, kids in foster care now don't have Medicaid cards, which years ago they did. That's a whole separate set of questions that have to be looked at. However, the other piece that's really critical is Medicaid funds are given to child care agencies to hire nurses and psychiatrists in-house. In my mind, the general delivery of general behavioral and health services through a Medicaid strategy, that's one side of the equation. However, the other side of the equation is the fact that Medicaid funds now support the hiring of those specialized professionals within a residential setting. If you take all that money and just pull it out and put it in a specialty managed care plan, you will eliminate those lines in those programs, and you either have to, and you can't expect a managed care plan to have the nurse come at 3 in the morning when a kid is having, a serious episode.
Right.
So we need to figure out, not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, figure out a way to handle that, either through other, I don't know, but that's something I wouldn't want to lose.
Yeah, and I think that we really struggled over how to talk about it because there's a 3-year window for kids in foster care to come into the managed care system, and there are different things that are needed across the life cycle for kids depending on what their residential arrangement is. So we're right with you.
Good. Okay.
And I'm sorry, but were you able to come up with a recommendation for how to think about that?
Well, the way we dealt with it was to say that they were basically categorically eligible for behavioral service, for specialty behavioral health care services, and we did not specify provider yet, but we basically created a right to service, and that was something that didn't exist before without them having to meet very strict clinical standards and other things. So the idea would be that the kids who have these needs have a guarantee of access to specialty behavioral health services, and TBD on exactly how it works. So like babies, you know, or young children might be treated one way. Kids in foster family care might be in another, treated a different way. Kids who are in residential placements would be maybe treated a third way, and we didn't really want to specify for those populations exactly how that would be. We just didn't have enough time.
Although the one thing you are saying that moves in the direction, I think, of addressing, Eileen, the issue you raise, is you're saying that these children should have entitlement to care.
Correct.
And it should be in a care management environment.
Correct.
So that sets up a solution. We don't know what the right solution is yet.
But it doesn't. That's my point. It's not a solution for those current funds supporting that nurse
Correct.
Who's on at 3 in the morning.
Yeah, we know what's going on there, and it's broken. And right. And you did have, I think, didn't Bill Getman participate in your group? So
and Jim Purcell from CAPA.
Jim Purcell, right.
There are people with tremendous familiarity, both operationally and policy-wise, about the issues, and I think it's really too detailed. It was really too detailed for us to do in 5 meetings, and I think it really warrants more attention. So
it may be just to that Eileen's point should have a little bit more. This needs to be unpacked,
mm-hmm.
you know, and here are the principles for unpacking it in the report.
Okay, got it.
This is a follow-up to that, and then I want to say a couple other things. The one thing we did talk about, while it didn't get specific, was the continuity of services idea, that if somebody sort of popped up and had this entitlement, which we thought was a document, was a good idea, that if they were already engaged in a care system, very similar to the conversation we had last time with this group, that there ought to be some ability for that family to stay engaged should they so choose to stay engaged with that provider. It may get at, period. That was one of the things. There are a couple of things that we emphasized, I think, in coming up with the recommendations that I'd like to just highlight, because this could easily become a case of the emperor's new clothes. We did talk about the lack of resources that currently exist. We also talked a lot about the whole issue of the unserved folks. And the presentation that Mike and Arlene did both weighed very, very heavily in the sense that so many kids come into the system, are treated in primary care settings. And so the idea was that there's really a need to substantially strengthen the service delivery system. And if we don't do that, you know, this system that we're talking about, kids won't be served. So again, the resource piece was emphasized a lot, and more in terms of addressing the kids who currently are not even being seen in the system. And almost all of the context was about early identification, early intervention, prevention, so that the more expensive services down the line, you know, didn't necessarily need to be as heavily utilized. And I think just one final point was the whole continuity of services thing. There was a sense that parents should not be overwhelmed by the system, you know, whether it's peer support or some other vehicle to help parents who are already dealing with difficult situations with their children, to make sure that the system is set up in such a way that access to services is easier, not harder.
Yes.
Just a couple of things. You know, Mike mentioned young people having their first break, but there's also the issue of kids transitioning from the children to the adult system and continuing to have developmentally appropriate services for them. And then dealing with the family issues because, you know, HIPAA kicks in at 18 and, you know, the day before the birthday, the parent was very involved in care and is not afterwards and, you know, how to deal with that issue. Also, you know, just to emphasize the importance of family support services, not only for parents and caregivers, but for foster parents who are dealing with kids with serious emotional disturbance.
Anybody else have a comment or a suggestion? what do I do now? Do I ask, what do I do? I just give it to you and then that's the end, or do we take a vote, or how does this work?
I think we're proceeding by acclamation, not by voting. But
thank you. We're so acclaimed.
Let me just sharpen that a little bit by saying, is there anything else that anybody needs in order to support this enthusiastically? I have a couple of
ideas put on the table, but is there anything else? This is not to say this shuts it off, because you may want to, you know, read this. This just got finished over the weekend. The last meeting was at the end of last week. So I guess sort of what I'm feeling is a lot of support, appreciation for you and the state agency staff and all the members who participated. And so the group as a whole will accept this and enter it into, you know, sort of final drafting. And if on reading any of this, any members have, you know, other concerns or suggestions to raise, but probably best get them to Gail as well as to Linda and I, and we'll make sure they're addressed.
Can I just add one comment? It's one of the other things we may want to keep in mind as the process goes forward, not right now. There's a lot of really terrific work here, and the other thing I'd point out is a lot of it means spending money, and that's, of course, not the genesis of the MRT. And so the extent to which this is such a good statement of principles and values and directions and issues, we really need to think about a way to quote, sell it down the road, including briefing to people, for example, in the health department who are not as familiar with some of the differences in children's services. So I think we, even if our work ends here, we need to figure out a way to be supportive going forward.
Yes. And so I just want to underline that because I really think it's true. And of course, when we get into budget stuff, the elephant in the room is DLB and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's particularly challenging in that, reading between the lines, the greatest area of underinvestment here is not so much in the specialty mental health system, but it's in the mainstream health systems, in pediatrics and primary care and school-based care and in all those other areas. And the question where the investment comes from to do a better job there, you know, now maybe just thinking out loud, if in fact we're able to provide less expensive, more appropriate care for people that ended up in a state hospital because they didn't get children's services, there might be a reinvestment from, adult state hospitals into pediatric behavioral health. You know, so if that, to the extent that's possible, I would support that. And Kristen has got us thinking about that on the one hand. On the other hand, these are duties and obligations of the mainstream health system that have not been carried out, you know, and so that there ought to be an investment here, in the part of kids above the neck, just as with adults. So I think we're going to just try to call that question, and I know Linda is concerned about this and committed to it, and I think we'll make that point in briefing the overall MRT, but this is also going to get into DOB land. So I think your point is well taken.
We've also, I think, repeatedly talked about the potential savings in the juvenile justice system and other systems where kids wind up if they don't. And so if we can, you know, make some kind of an argument there as well.
So, Gail, terrific. Thank you. Thank the other members who are here and those who are not. That's terrific. So, Harvey and Ellen as Harvey, or Harvey as Ellen, are
playing the role of Ellen.
But let me turn on my mic. So, thank you, Mike. I've got a couple of pieces to do. One of them is the piece that Mike asked Ellen and the coalition and the group she represents, which is the Coalition to Protect the Integrity of Peer Support. And they've sent me an email that I've been unpacking, and I hope I get it right, that updates a little bit of what they've already shared with you all. So I don't know if you have anything in front of you, but they have some new material. Mike, before I go forward, though, just a sense of timing, is this our last time we talked about how the recommendations we're making have to will influence the managed care system of a year from now, and I felt like this, you were all supportive of our group continuing, and I've heard that even from the governor's office. Are we? Is this our last meeting, or are we continuing?
Can I suggest on that, that maybe at the end, Mike and I have talked a little bit about next steps and how we're...
The only reason I asked it now is because we're
I think for recommendations, our goal would be that this would be the last, just in terms of
okay,
forming
well,
the recommendations.
Okay, well, I hope I do well then.
Great, okay.
All right, so basically this is a collaborative sort of input from both the coalition and NIAPRS in a number of discussions. So the first thing, I think there's a whole concern about rights and choice in the managed care and health home environment. And so there's a real recommendation that there be some form of peer educators or brokers or who really provide a lot of information. You know, the peer community is in the dark about all these changes that are coming so quick and ultimately affecting them. So to the extent to which the state, the health homes, the managed care companies to come, all are very sensitive to and try to provide. There was a time when we were back at the SNPs, we were talking about enrollment brokers, you may recall, and there are enrollment brokers in managed care in some form. So certainly an interest in that kind of brokerage, that kind of education, and also people that might also play some sort of a navigator role and certainly do a lot of education around rights advocacy. There's an example of that was, according to the coalition, is that the prepaid mental health plan had a peer education project in 1996 that established and paid for a group of peers to provide this education as OMH was enrolling people into the prepaid mental health plan. There's a recommendation here also that there be some sort of 24-hour hotline for people going into health homes and managed care that really picks up the concerns of peers and is able to unpack what's going on and respond to them, and that there be education around grievance and appeals process in particular, and some education around that process and some assistance where appropriate. I'm just trying to read my notes here. So there's a great concern up front around privacy protections in managed care and health homes. There's a welcoming of the use of electronic medical records with the hope that advanced directors will have their proper place mm-hmm. and at long last be used, but a concern about any kind of leakage, undesired leakage for the consumer of their privacy information, that the consumer be able to access their records. I'll try to write all this up and send it in on a regular basis. And again, that there be this peer advocate role in health homes and what have you. The group then has gone forward and tried to get more concrete about how peer services fit into these health home managed care environments. So in the area of, we recognize that peer service, this is about where peer services fit in an environment that's about improving lives and saving dollars through these vehicles. So certainly in the outreach and engagement process, which is a big piece of the health home and will be a big piece of the managed care, there's, you know, the group really talks a lot about the importance of trust and hope and support and choice and partnership and mutuality. Those of us that have done the peer wellness coaching and chronic illness demos recognize that it's not about pursuing people to enroll them and get them to accept a diagnosis and see a doctor and take their medicine. That's not the point of engagement. That's not where it should start. It should really start with the person and their self-directed needs and really making that alignment. And that's the importance of peers, that they're able to provide that hope and that personal relationship with the healthcare system and be able to translate that into a service plan and advocate with the treatment team to make that service plan responsive in the words and in the hopes of the consumer. There's a thought that drop-in centers and that peer wellness coaches are particularly strong and increasingly evidence-based approach that ought to be in health homes and ought to be in managed care, and also that there be some role, again, about brokerage and in education and information and advocacy. In terms of the actual services and the service package, once people are engaged, outreached and engaged, there's a desire that the focus of the, again, plan be on wellness, on strengths, as much as on symptoms and on illness and on pills and doctors and clinics, that there be a real focus on meaningful roles in the community, a life beyond symptoms and patienthood, that recovery is expected for each person, The hope is that in these health homes where there are new plans developed for each person, some people will now have seven plans with this doctor and that mental health worker and that substance abuse agency. The hope is in a health home there'll be one new fresh plan, and that that plan be very strengths-based, recovery-oriented, peer-informed, trauma-informed, as a matter of fact, and culturally competent. And that, again, that peer wellness coaches, peer recovery centers can play some support here. Peer support groups are an important resource to the treatment sort of process, the recovery process. And again, a focus on not just getting people, you know, as we heard in the Susan Essick presentation, God bless her, but we want to see the service system being more than getting somebody to their doctor in 7 days and taking their medicine, that it be the full package of well health, wellness, recovery, community integration, and again, the connection between housing and employment and peer support. Let's see. Transitional support is an important thing. We have lots of people cycling between institutions like hospitals to community, detox to community, adult home to community, prison and jail to community. The Peer Bridger model, which OMH and NIAPRS and other people have helped birth and has taken root around the country, really belongs in this model. And that, you know, there's a great application to transitional support. It's a critical time to unpack what a crisis was and help somebody move into a life in recovery and to avoid an avoidable readmission and a emergency room visit. In terms of crisis, relapse prevention and support, again, a strong urge that wellness recovery action plans be incorporated in treatment, that intentional peer support is really critical, and that there are a variety of peer services, whether they be warm lines, respite programs, peers in the emergency room. There are even emergency peer workers that come to people's homes, peers with the police. There's insertion of peers in critical moments to change the way the system responds to people in crisis and to be very responsive and yet not overly coercive. Rights protections on that topic are really critical, so peer advocacy in should be inserted in every one of these models. People are trained about their advance directive rights, their grievance and appeal rights, their benefits and entitlements, education, there'd be some real thought and use of that. There's a whole cadre of peer services that are at the ready for that. The question for a lot of these things is going to be, how do you pay for them, by the way? And I think that goes back to the reinvestment sort of question we've talked about. Peer services in all our domains are largely paid for by state aid at this time, and they're very variable. But there's an opportunity here to really raise up their level. Certainly in OMH, we have your recovery centers, TA. We're hoping to go out, and that's one of the focuses of that training project and technical assistance. Finally, a real concern that the menu of treatment expand to alternative healing. We looked at managed care to be able to consider buying the things that people use now sparingly, too sparingly, that middle-class people get to use to recover, including acupuncture, massage, aromatherapy, Reiki, Shiatsu, meditation, and that these things be available to peers to fill out the benefit package and the path to healing. So I think I've got that first piece.
Phew.
So, questions? Sort of slow this down. One question, Harvey, is where's the group? I know this is people have been of several minds about this, but
coming to Solidarity.
Okay. Yeah, on Medicaid.
I'm going to get to that next.
Okay. All right. Good. Because just to sort of step outside and comment on this, there's been an ongoing debate in the peer movement about whether peer services reimbursed through Medicaid are, you know, sort of on the one hand the way to humanize the system, or on the other hand the selling out to a, you know, medical professional model.
We have the answer.
Good.
Okay,
cool.
So if you look at this document that you should have gotten when you were outside, one of the nice things about the MRT was it actually so valued peer services that there was an MRT recommendation 1058 called Maximize Peer Service. And that triggered a series of meetings. If you're on this document, I'm going to race through it because we really don't have a lot of time.
And they also so valued this group that they asked this group to take ownership of and
support
you're,
these
You're the only path that we have to the MRT, so
okay.
we need your approval and support. But there's been a group of us that have been meeting for four sessions or more that include people from the mental health community, substance use community, independent living community, and I'll tell you more about that. But the health department has convened, put out a call for input and feedback on the top of page one. And the reactions included that there be comprehensive care coordination teams that include peer supports, that target independent living skills. We talked about a variety of peer-run crisis respites and recovery centers, recovery coaches in substance use, peer support specialists, et cetera. We held four meetings, and we've met a number of times. There was a survey that got reactions from 46 stakeholder organizations, and the OMH Recipient Affairs Advisory Committee responded, representing 400 people. And so what the findings were that, of course, as you would not be surprised, we believe peer services are unique and extremely valuable and play a critical role at this point of trying to really engage people in person-centered care that really engages them and improves health and wellness. The basis of peer support, we make a distinction, of course, from the medical model. The focus is, in our minds, a little more on the whole individual and on their strengths and capacities. It's not the same as case management. We've had a number of discussions with managed care companies where they approach peer groups and say they're really looking for an assistant case manager to get people to take their medicine. That is not peer support. That peer supporters may wind up getting into a discussion on medication, but that's not where they lead. They're not dispatched by the entity to go out and get those people to take their medication. That, however, may wind up being one of the outcomes of the relationship. If you get down to the survey results, let's see. So there were a number of findings. Funding sources for peer support. The recommendations included donations, grants, state, county, and local funding. We looked at Medicaid-funded waiver services. We looked at Medicaid, Mike. We reviewed some of the history of the way peer services have been funded in New York. It's very variable. I think DOH was really shocked with the number of, they kept saying, the extent to which peer support actually exists in the OASIS and the OMH, in the independent living and in the DOH systems. So they were impressed with that, and certainly it bore out why they need to be maximized. Most of the peer groups that were surveyed recommended funding for peer services that is flexible and grant-based. There's a concern that peer services not be directly Medicaid reimbursed, and then by definition, and often, all too often, then seen as somebody that's going to be supervised by a social worker and part of a medically based treatment team. The hope is that the health homes and the managed care groups will subcontract with accredited, approved peer-run groups that have true fidelity to the peer models, and that they in turn will make available peers who are not personally certified at this point, but that the subcontract peer agency is accredited, and that they are, and that the state encourages, that this group encourages health homes and most of all managed care to seek and subcontract with peer services for all, in many of the roles we've talked about already. We think that choice and careful matching of individuals with peers is really important, and there should be really clear standards and qualifications. Again, the fear is for peers is that they're going to be, the worst case for this group is that they be medicated, supervised by a non-peer, and sent out as an assistant case manager to get people to take their medicine or bring the van around. It's really, peer support has all these other domains, relational skills and importance, and a whole cadre of new service approaches that we think ought to be accredited and subcontracted with. And again, some of the things I mentioned earlier about wellness recovery action plans, advanced directives, alternative support, self-advocacy, peer crisis respite. We recognize that in the CIDP, peers played a major role. We recognize that peers are increasingly helping people leave hospitals and jails and prisons and detoxes, and that they're really ought to play major roles in the environment to come. I'll take you really, we looked at an Arizona program in particular where they have a waiver, Arizona Community Services Agency waiver for peer and family services, maximizing the ability of peer and family organizations to not certify workers, but subcontract with a peer-run program. Again, not subjecting the peer to be under a licensed a licensed clinician and such. I'm just cognizant of time. I'll get to the final page, which is page 9. The final recommendations are that, again, peer services are unique and valuable, that we should facilitate ways to accommodate Medicaid funding for peer services, such as waivers, grants, and funding for programs rather than the position itself. Funding for training and education certification and leadership development would strengthen the peer workforce. We recommend establishing an accreditation process for peer-run agencies, which would professionalize their activities and require that supervision be provided by a trained peer to preserve the unique whole health, whole wellness approach that peers provide. We agree that peers ought to be incorporated into health homes as a required element in the health home application. Again, hope that that happened in a subcontract with the peer agency. And we conclude that we should address children and their care separately.
So I think this is great, and you only said one thing that made me nervous, and that was that we should be relying someplace in here, you said, on grant funds, and that makes me nervous because grants come and go.
Well, we mean, I think, managed care grants, health
care
grants.
Okay.
We
don't mean like other categorical grants.
To take care of this.
So, look, here's what I think in the, for whatever it's worth, category.
When they have that capitated pool of money.
Yeah, I got it. But
to redirect.
Here's the thing, Harvey. I think that I think it's stronger to sort of make a stab at nudging the Medicaid system so that it reflects what we want than to depend on other sort of standalone categorical sources of money, because it's risky. And so I think in terms of a recommendation, this is what Medicaid ought to do. This is what Medicaid ought to be providing for on the theory that it's in the long run cost effective, whatever. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, but the problem is our central premise is what makes you nervous.
But
I mean, well, she was saying she liked everything I said except the central premise, which was that he shouldn't be.
No. It wasn't. No, you're misunderstanding what I'm saying. What I'm trying to say is I think that you want to go where the money is always, right? And that's why I'm saying that it makes me a little nervous. That one, I mean, I view a funding stream as a per member, per month stream of money. That I might not get, in which you structure clearly that peer work has got to be one of the criteria, as in the health home. And then I think you're able to go there for funding. Do you know what I'm saying?
It's the difference between discretionary and entitlement funding.
Yes.
That's what Pam is saying. It's, you know, philosophically,
it's stronger for peers to be in.
If you're using the funding from the basic Medicaid program, it's an entitlement. It's not entitled that everybody gets peer service, but it's part of a system of entitlements, just like a part of a system of benefits in managed care. If it depends on separate grants here and there, they come and go. That's how we do business versus not.
I appreciate what you're saying. I think the concern, though, is that given the discussions that we've had so far, peer groups, including ours, have had, there's a lot of anxiety about a straight Medicaid reimbursement that will be very illness-oriented and sort of kind of co-opted into the traditional
model.
Would
have to be an explicit mandate in the law.
Can I jump on this?
I'm
really struggling today. I feel like I'm living in sort of two different worlds.
We can help.
With the couch. I was talking to Mike before the meeting started. I was telling him about the process that's been going on in my company where we've been meeting with and looking at various aspects of the Health Home Initiative. And I brought Harvey in to meet with our clinical people around medication. And so this part of this process, which is really exciting and positive, is that people I work with in a mainstream managed care plan who are not knowledgeable, particularly some are, but primarily the people I'm talking to are not knowledgeable about behavioral issues in their more nuanced way, and certainly not knowledgeable about peer supports, about all the new organizations. So it's been this wonderfully exciting period for me to start educating people who never heard of some of this stuff. And one of the things, you know, that we had a meeting the other day with NAMI was in. And NAMI was saying they have all these great programs which really make a difference in the outcomes for people. These are for the families. Well, the question now coming from a managed care plan, and it would be from the health department or anybody else in this world also, is this all sounds great. Now, tell me what evidence do we have that shows how it works. And I'm always bothering Harvey for articles because he sometimes actually has them, which is terrific. But when we look at managed care and when you look at that amount of money that you get for a member per month, we look at the use of effective interventions that have a measured impact. It can't just feel good. It has to be measurable, and it particularly has to improve outcomes and reduce unnecessary expenditures. Obviously, inpatient psych care is one of those that is a place where we could have some savings if we do other things. So as we talk about all this, it won't become real and it won't become part of the capitation unless there's some real rigorous evidence-based basis for all this. And I mean, and I'm committed, so.
And I appreciate that, but I have to say, when we were having the debate in New York about the BHO, we went up talking to most of the BHOs, and one of the things that attracted our group to the BHOs was that they had all contracted with peers and had some data. Whether,
no, that's the BHOs, not the plans. You're right.
Right, but nonetheless, they used some form of capitated money or flexible money to purchase, and they had good outcomes that they had documented.
I'm convinced. You don't have to convince me, but I'm really saying that as a field, we're also talking about re-education of clinicians. This is a whole philosophical change and one that's way overdue, and it's fantastic. But there are lots of clinicians out there that wouldn't want to talk to a peer support person. So we're really talking about, in a way, almost revolutionizing the way we do behavioral health. I think that's fabulous. We have to realize that we're taking something that big on and make it happen.
And, of course, that's happened to a greater degree in addiction treatment than mental health treatment. I mean, you know, that isn't that really the origin of the CASAC credential? It's essentially sort of a peer-plus credential that's now become mainstream in a way. I think Donna and then John.
Can you turn on your thing? Is that on now?
No,
now. A couple of things on the financing issues as well as on some of the concerns around data. First of all, I do think that for us to have a real opportunity to bring in different menu of type of services, they have to be within the whole rubric of managed care and not the overhead that proves that we can save money. So it has to be part of the per member. Part of a waiver, I mean, we've talked a little bit about what would a bigger waiver allow us to do in terms of some flexibly delivered services that aren't currently Medicaid funded. Getting into a completely different mindset, it's not a medical model recovery oriented, but it has to be, can't be a one-off, meaning it's a grant, it's a managed care entity who is interested in exploring whether this option works, but has to take it out of their, not out of their Medicaid per member per month, but out of their administrative costs to prove that they can actually save money. Because we need to be part of the full rubric of the menu of services. And I think with the issue of can you prove that it works, I mean, what I was actually with Wendy when we met with Eileen last week, and we can't prove something that we haven't had an opportunity to prove. We don't have the data. But on the other hand, we know what hasn't exactly worked, which is the current system that we have now. So the opportunity to see, to test within that rubric new ideas and new ways, I think will be something going forward that we're going to have to take a look at, whether it's family to family or peer supports, in ways that we can kind of connect the dots and say, this really does make a difference. Now, you know, everyone's got to be retrained. I mean, for the whole system, and that's been, you know, a common theme here, that people, clinicians, providers, you know, have to change their mindset. But I think I would go for being part of the whole rubric and not outside of it to grant and support that. And also, you know, fight for the idea that we have to study whether these things work, but we want to be part of the mainstream of that, not off to the side what we're trying to figure out how to shift the mainstream.
So just to underline this point, and then John, you're up next. But so in a sense, I think, Harvey, this is a very supportive feedback back to the group that says, yes, we're really buying this, and we would like the group, maybe this is the larger group, to struggle or wrestle a little bit more with what are the circumstances under which Medicaid funding would be viable in terms of preserving the integrity that you're so concerned about, but also making it, you know, a mainstream kind of thing as opposed to something that's done with leftover funds.
Right.
That's just something to think about. And I'm also thinking that, you know, I don't know how this is going to work, whether I assume that we, Linda, ultimately present jointly present the report here to the MRT. It would sort of be funny in a way for us to present this report to the MRT. So I'm assuming you and some of the other members should be there to, you know, to hand this off to the whole MRT.
Oh, why wouldn't you want it in the body of?
Well, because this is actually a whole separate MRT work group.
Right.
That didn't get established as a formal subcommittee.
I see.
And so they're sort of coming back through us.
I see.
So I think we're prepared to carry it forward. Assuming
you would, you see yourself as moving it forward, but you'd like it to be explained on ground.
Then I think you should be there, and other members, maybe from the independent living, somebody from the addiction recovery, ought to be there.
Okay.
I'm assuming that's okay with you to sort of hand that off. Not just us guys. But anyway, John.
Just a couple thoughts. I mean, I think one of the things that the document does talks a lot about peer support as a sort of a conceptual idea that peer support should be an important part of the continuum, et cetera. And I think, when we start drilling down to actual data, if we were to talk about, let's say, just an addiction field specifically, because I think that the section on substance use could be strengthened considerably, the three items that are mentioned here with the recovery coaches and the recovery centers and the OASIS grant is a lot of that's just kind of the new stuff that's just started happening in the last year or so. I guess my thought is that more globally, if we, and again, I think OASIS has got a considerable amount of data from programs that are seen as treatment programs and in some cases prevention programs where you use peers, I think we could probably extrapolate a lot of data from therapeutic communities, for instance. And again, I think if we use language, it really talks a lot about 12-step programs, 12-step resources, therapeutic communities, and places where people who are in recovery from addiction are actually, driving the treatment. I think there's probably a lot of data that would relate to arrests, rearrests, sobriety, employment, housing, and would really, I think, substantiate the idea of peer services. So I think there's a lot that we can probably get from OASIS that would really support this idea of peer, the importance of the peer. Period. I just think there's a rich history in the substance use disorder field, which is not necessarily reflected in this document. I think if we sort of emphasize more the actual kinds of successful services as opposed to the model itself, I think it would sort of speak for
itself. Those would be 12-step and TCs? Is that
therapeutic communities and, even like in the prevention area where you got peer leadership, you have all kinds of sort of peer-driven kids working with kids, adults working with adults.
You want to shift some of that over?
Of course.
Okay,
yeah.
I'll pass it on.
So, Wendy?
I just feel I have to say that in any peer lending, both family and consumer-led services, I think it's because there are a lot of consumers who live at home, and the more involved their families are, probably the other things are going to be very hard to worry concerns. I haven't said this, but I felt this very strongly. There is a huge cultural issue, both in accepting family and consumer to meaningfully participate in treatment. And this is not the right form for this, but none of this stuff is going to happen unless we can figure out how people are really going to start participating in some kind of cultural change, which is really hard and takes up a great deal of long time. It's just sort of peer support, family lenses, and they're both really appropriate. And nobody kind of really needs that enough.
I agree with you, and one of the things I, again, going back to the BHO, I was fascinated by some of the, just the, one of the companies talked about how they did a recovery academy with all their providers and re-educated them, and they spent their own money doing it, and they also bought peer and family services and put it part of the menu, so.
So just more than that, if you want peers to be meaningful members of the staff to really be listened to and to really be part of things, that's going to inspire us.
So one of the my reactions, I think that that advancing the entirety of a separate report is something that we ought to do so that it stands on its own. But I actually took from your comments and from actually way back to when we set our principles here in this room that the point of view that this group shared around the peer work was that it was something that should be inherent to the service. It wasn't an ancillary or an adjunct service. It was actually inherent in the manner of the practice as a whole. And I think our report should reflect that. And so we can, so I think we should work on how to pull some of it up, make sure we get it into our recommendations, make sure that it's not described as a service but is actually inherent. And then your report then will, you know, it's sort of a, an embellishment on that and probably has some broader applicability. So,
amen. Yeah. I'll just also point out that within the last year or so, I don't know exactly, but there have been, I know at least one, I don't know whether it's a randomized study or a quasi-experimental study. I think it's quasi-experimental, but there's evidence now of a research study on the effectiveness of family to family. So that was randomized. And also on RAP, Judith Cook published a study with effectiveness of RAP training. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, there still is not, to my knowledge, one randomized control trial showing better outcomes from inpatient than alternatives. Now, we know that it's useful, but that doesn't mean that we have evidence for it. And, you know, and I sit here also as the one person I know that had a successful back operation, but there's, like, no evidence for that either. But we continue to do these things. Anyway,
thank you, Mike.
I have just one. I'm sorry. I know we should move on, but I just have one last concern, and forgive me for sounding like a biased New Yorker, but when you say Arizona, I think minimal, really minimal. And so not meaning to sound unduly paranoid or jaded, but the state of Arizona is not known for fulsome coverage for sick people. And so my concern
is Arizona's on the call.
No. My point is this, that this may be a model program, but it shouldn't be.
Forget
that
about it.
Someone. No. It's about money, of course. It shouldn't be that the assumption gets made, oh, peer, you know, peers, oh, that's cheaper.
Exactly, but yeah, I would unpack those as two separate things, though. I think, I mean, I think that the reference to Arizona wasn't around whether it was cheap or not.
No,
it was the flexibility given the peer services in their waiver design.
I understand, and I wasn't picking on Arizona per se.
I was
simply saying that it shouldn't be that this program, that these kinds of services shouldn't be seen as, oh, we'll do that. It's cheaper than having, you know, a licensed healthcare. That's all.
Right.
Okay, so we're going to move on now because, like, Melinda, when you got finished talking, everybody was like, yes, and then I talked some more. Harvey, thank you. And so, as Linda said, our group will accept and move forward the report of the working group, but also work to incorporate some of the underlying concepts a little bit stronger into our efforts. So, Anne, uninsured people, can you just give us a little background and then your recommendations?
Thank you. I want to thank Mike and Linda for letting us bring this up as a little bit of a separate topic, because obviously we're not a task force on the uninsured. We're here to deal with Medicaid redesign. But I think as most of us who work with the Medicaid population and work with these populations, we're aware of how
There is some interplay, at least in the, even in the current system, between what we do in Medicaid and what we do for the uninsured. And that as we redesign Medicaid, there could be unintended consequences on what we have historically been able to provide for the uninsured currently within the system. So we kind of narrowed the scope for the 10 of us who were able to get together to talk really about how to preserve what's currently in the system and at least to bring to the attention of those who are redesigning Medicaid this issue, that some of these ways that we have designed our system to date have supported some of the services for the uninsured, and that we don't want to lose that. And also some of the countermeasures, which are obviously if you lose some of those supports, you're going to increase probably Medicaid costs in the area of emergency Medicaid and hospitalizations and other things and jails and prisons. And we just wanted to kind of highlight this so that this could also be seen by the group that's overall redesigning Medicaid. So the scope here is a little bit circumspect. It's not to solve all the problems of the uninsured because that's not what we were here for. So if we just look at this draft, which we put together kind of quickly, so we're really open for lots of other suggestions, is to look at primarily the uninsured. The group we're talking about are the seriously mentally ill or the serious substance abusers. We're not talking about all of the uninsured. And to the extent that the care provided to these particularly at-risk and vulnerable individuals might be affected by some of the changes that we're putting into the redesign of Medicaid. So we just very briefly outlined the current state of what uninsured means, because uninsured is a complex group of individuals. Some of them, the most drastic, are those that are undocumented and uninsured, but there's lots of levels of uninsured. Sometimes you've used up your benefits. Sometimes you just haven't been able to apply appropriately for benefits. Sometimes you fall off because you didn't renew your benefits. So the uninsured is a big catch-all, and it includes all of these. And some of them more directly affected by Medicaid redesign, such as making sure clients who are eligible get their eligibility. And then there are others who rapidly fall out of Medicaid. We talked a little bit, just to outline, certainly not in all the ways, but some of the ways we've traditionally supported the treatment of the uninsured, especially for the seriously ill. ACT teams have had percentages of their patients that are uninsured as part, accepted as part of the grant funding that went to those. Similarly, TCMs, a lot of OASIS grant programs had certain percentages of uninsured included in those, and they were deficit funded. Housing programs also receive some deficit funding, some programs for the uninsured. City and tax levy funds, in addition to those matches, become deficit funding for the uninsured. The COPS rates, which traditionally enhanced rates to clinics across the city, are not going to be in the way we know them in the new system, but those enhanced rates in indirect ways allows agencies to have flexibility sometimes to take on higher percentages of the uninsured. And when that's no longer there, how are you going to deal with the uninsured that come to your door? We also know that public sector systems have high percentages of the uninsured. And we know that if we don't have these services, we don't let the uninsured in some way, that we often increase emergency Medicaid costs, ER costs, and certainly lots of these, and this came from both the city and upstate areas, many of these patients end up in jails and prisons, and their cost is escalated there. So you end up paying one way or the other. So we wanted to come up with a few principles that we thought could at least highlight some of these issues, and the principles are three. One, that as all behavioral Medicaid patients are moved into managed care, the needs of the uninsured that our system of care currently provides must continue to be addressed. We don't leave in the dust the clients that currently are being served. Two, that if appropriate services are not provided for the high-risk population, there will be further cost shifting to other systems, criminal justice, emergency Medicaid. And then three, since I think everyone kind of agrees that children should be insured, just to ensure that all children in need of appropriate receive benefits provided by their insurers. And the recommendations were that we have a mechanism of funding the appropriate current levels of service to the uninsured and underinsured needs to be maintained as the system moves into managed Medicaid for all clients. We also wanted to recommend that the uninsured population, that we will, if we are serving them, that they also be in care coordination and management, and that just not become some kind of other system. That it would make sense, just like for all patients, that they receive care coordination and care management.
that the ability to buy in for certain clients into Medicaid and design of the proposed insurance exchanges, that these address some of the complex issues for the seriously chronically mentally ill and substance abuse users. Because one problem here could be that you want to be able to capture those people that are insurable, and you want to make sure that the seriously mentally ill have real access to those insurance exchanges, et cetera. That's the other level of the uninsured. And then lastly, that we ask that all the various commercial programs be watched carefully, including insurance exchanges, for parity. That's federal legislation. It's also state legislation, and that we have to be careful because often those, despite the fact that they're law, they have not been adopted by all insurers, either in New York or across the country. So it's a brief statement, I think, that highlighted some of the key issues without getting too far afield, so that we weren't out there trying to say that we were going to solve all the problems of the uninsured. But we would be glad to have anyone's comments or thoughts or additions, whatever.
Thanks, Ann. That's concise. That's direct. Yes, questions, comments?
By and large, they should be covered by two things, whatever your state parity laws are, and we have some, and then also by the federal parity law, which essentially is saying that you really have to have a similar benefit almost for both sides. But insurers have not always followed that, and they are not even following it currently. There's a big push.
The state law has a mandate, the federal law does not. The federal. Is there a mandate for this? At the federal level, no.
There is a parity mandate, but it's not a deep benefit. It's like a 30-60 kind of there is something there, but and I think it might defer to the state law. So it's not nothing, but it's not deep end parity with rehabilitation services.
The federal parity in the Affordable Care Act, it is expanded in 2014 when the exchanges are up and running, the plans are available. Current parity in New York, and I can speak for SUD services in particular, there are, you call them parity, there's mandates in state law for a certain amount of outpatient detox, and there's a make available rider provision for inpatient rehab. With the parity as it exists already, because that became law in 2009, those are now the floor, not the ceiling. You can't go below those. But parity in and of itself says across all the spectrums, to break it down really simply, if you treat the physical health benefits poorly, you can treat the mental health and substance use benefits poorly. However you treat one, you have to treat the other. But it will broaden. Right now, the parity, though, only applies for 50 employee or more group policy.
Well, but don't forget the 8 biologically based disorders. The
right.
Key other part of Timothy's law is there are 8 biologically based categories of disorders where you cannot have an artificial limit on the number of services.
Right.
You just have to, it's just like you don't have an artificial number on the kind of diabetes services.
Right.
Same idea.
The goal is just to make sure that we maximize whatever we can get from
And there's one other potential risk that you didn't address explicitly, and I wonder whether it would be appropriate to include it, and that is the fact that the disproportionate share dollars are at risk and that these dollars are not insubstantial in certain sectors of our system.
I'd be glad to put that in. I think there was a little we felt we might be reaching into something that we weren't supposed to reach in.
It seems to me that's pretty important. And we don't at the front of the table here have the appropriating pen, but we ought to be making recommendations about what the right thing to do is. And
that sort of cuts across a whole swath. I mean, that's really beyond
right.
mental health, right?
But, right. Yes, so that going beyond behavioral health would not be our purview, but to the extent that those resources are applied to behavioral health might be a way to, would that be appropriate?
If we might, could you just explain just briefly that they're at risk and
disproportionate share dollars essentially go away under health reform.
Yeah.
And there's a general theory that with other resources rising, they're not going to be needed. But, you know, if you look, for example, at HHC and services to, you know, that people might be, you know, in the country without full, you know, benefits, they're getting a lot of care, and it's really covered indirectly by a disproportionate share. So,
yeah.
We'd be glad to, I think the group would be glad to add
yeah.
that as number five.
Great.
Okay.
Are there any other? So thank you for taking this on quickly and a cogent report. So I think we want to turn now to going through the recommendations that, by and large, we've already discussed, but we want to look at them as they're sort of evolving here. So I don't know what Andy, you know, what how do we want to do this? You want to do this on the computer? Now, here's the thought. So you should have now a with the stuff when you came in, it's a first workup. And as I said before, there's a lot of you know, introduction and context and finessing this that has yet to happen. But what we want to particularly focus on is the guts of this, which are the recommendations. And so if you have your paper copy. The recommendations start on page 7.
Michael,
really? I have a.
Getting
around
time,
for
Pete's sake. So.
There was a big pile out there, but there's a few actually.
We're on page 7.
Anyone else need? Let me see if I can.
So. Andy's going to bring this up on the computer, and I think here's my recommendation about how to go through this. There are a couple of broad and overarching recommendations, and then what you'll see is that in the body of this thing that you've got, there are, I think, five major categories, financing and payment, contracting, eligibility, care of the mainstream, and a couple more, HIT, performance metrics,
mm-hmm.
special issues. Actually, there are more than that, so there's a lot of stuff here. And I think what I'd like for us to do is to take a look at these by category and not go item by item, but sort of start with the broad principles and then go to each category. And I think the threshold ought to be major discomfort or something really important is missing. Okay? So,
hold on just a second. Does anyone know, is there a way to make this bigger on the screen or sort of make the cover screen or make it work?
I don't know how to do that.
Sorry, we in translating here, we seem to have lost a little formatting. I think it's fine. Hopefully you can all look at this one there.
Yeah, Kelly?
Yeah.
We want to leave with consensus sufficient to allow final drafting that's consistent with the consensus. You know, so we're not going to do fine print, but you know, sort of by the end of the day today, A, we ought to be comfortable with what we've got here, and B, there ought to be no surprises when you get, you know, a final copy.
So how about a 5-minute reading?
Okay. We can do it if we want. Take a little break, start on bottom of page 6, top of page 7. Just take a quick look through this. And we're looking for major, this is like not editing, but major challenges, and big things that are missing, big oops in terms of how the stuff is raised. Thank you. says.
What page is that on? Under six?
For the first year.
Page five, number six.
I'm sure a lot of people will be happy with that.
You know, I think we should jump into this because we're, and maybe take a brief look when we get to each section, so we can, because going through the whole thing is going to be sort of disjointed here. So I don't worry. The overarching recommendations. I think this is pretty straightforward. Just I don't think we need to spend any time on this, but there are four broad overarching recommendations that say, you know, the first one says, yes, we should do what the MRT has already agreed to do.
Yeah, right.
Second, if the state is going to use an 1115 waiver to advance that, we should be included. Then so a statement about recovery and meaningful life roles. And then a statement that we're about restructuring the system for improvement. This is not just the status, not a status quo, and that is going to need to include, if we're going to restructure and improvement, it's going to have to include an intention for reinvestment of savings. So I'm pretty straightforward with that. Yeah, Dr. Shah?
I mean, this is, I discussed this at the end of the last meeting about we're not committing to the actual model. Here, only whichever model is in place, it'll embrace these principles and recommendations.
That's correct.
So BHO versus SNP versus...
Yes, that's my understanding, right. We're not going to dictate which one of those it is. Would apply to whichever one was selected. The only exception to that is that the city has made it clear that its intention is to proceed with a special needs plan. So we've been explicit in that regard. With respect to the other regions, we're sort of deferring the question of will it be a SNP, will it be some kind of a carved-out arrangement until we get a little further down the road. But as you said, the recommendations here are intended to apply to either.
Because some are easier to integrate into one model than the other in terms of physical health services vis-a-vis a BHO versus having a model that implicitly has both services covered.
Yeah, there are always advantages and disadvantages to categories. Ed Gill? Well, either we're in favor of an increase in undetected crime, which I don't think we've... Right. Yeah, it's a little...
So all the stuff up until page six actually came from our original principles document that we reviewed multiple times in this group. So we didn't do any work on that section. We just basically cut it and pasted it in, which doesn't mean we can't do further work on that section because Kirby's pointing out a place where we may not have addressed one of his concerns and questions. But just to make that point, we did nothing fresh and new on that section until we get to page seven.
Okay, so let's move forward. So we'll move to the financing and payment section. And I don't know what the best way to do this, Andy. We don't want
to
read all these things.
I think we could just
make
talk
a comment
a little
about,
bit about
yeah.
So on financing and payment, maybe I can just sort of give a theme for each bullet. One is the first one is about sort of how capitation setting should be done, and it should be based on prior service spending, which would include funding for care coordination that is being pulled out of targeted care management and other programs, and into health homes should go right back into the sort of capitation, and that you shouldn't be looking for savings in the first year. The first year that you go to a risk-based arrangement. Second one is that there should be, should we do one by one question?
And I just want to make sure, so you're saying, just on that last sentence on the first bullet, savings should not be targeted for the first year of risk-based and healthcare managed care. Savings for state, savings for plan.
So the state, in other words, the state.
That means it's going to cost at least as much as
year one. This is our recommendation.
Yeah.
Our recommendation is year one,
right,
you should have the full spending from the prior year. It's the only way that plans can start to think about reinvestment is if the savings aren't taken out before they even start.
Right.
That's the thought.
Savings should not be taken for the first year. Just so I state what it is.
Does that make sense? Okay. Second bullet, there should be transparency in the premium so that we can have some sense of what spending is attributable to behavioral health services and what for other kinds of services. And the goal here, this is the goal to make sure that there's not sort of a shift that is unseen and unrecognized between behavioral health spending and physical health spending, just transparency in sort of sectors in which the spending is done. Third, that there should be formal mechanisms for the reinvestment of Medicaid savings into clinical and non-clinical services. There's a lot of mechanisms to do it, but there should be a formal mechanism for it. And obviously, more wording there, but that's the basic principle. And the last bullet is that non-Medicaid savings in state and local systems should also be tracked. Again, this is sort of a transparency point, but if there are savings that are created for an improved behavioral health care system, let's say, in other systems, that should be tracked, and we should be aware of that.
Now, should we be commenting on any suggestions on that, this, that section she just read?
Yeah.
Can I just say, can we just add the word peer to examples of things that reinvest in high-priority areas like housing? We usually said housing and peer services. Employment and family support. We could just include that there.
You know, I can't remember
if it's, I knew you'd ask me that, and I always get confused whether it's small or large group, but it's 85% has to be, and if you don't, is that large group or large and small? It's about, I think it's both. And then if it's a large group, if you don't hit that number, you have to give the money back to the plan, to the group, like a group of, you know, 2,000 people. If you don't hit certain ratios, you have to give a refund under current practice and law.
Would it make people comfortable if we added a bullet somewhere or a principle that whatever sort of requirements and other things that apply to managed care already, what of existing managed care requirements would be assumed to be the default in this system unless otherwise, you know, recommended? I was thinking, generally speaking, you would sort of, unless
we've assumed them for the purpose of the recommendation.
We have
to,
so far,
unless you change the law.
We have so far assumed
them, but
differences where, you know,
yeah,
the recommendations,
yeah,
point to areas where we think the standard should be different. But.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to
that's what I'm suggesting.
Philip, did you want to add?
Well, I like that, but I just wanted to be, I guess I'm not familiar with the law, so this law is across all managed care?
The New York State Insurance Department.
Period, okay.
The state insurance law.
So if there were changes or if we wanted to change that, we would have to do it through the...
Well, there's a couple of sets of laws affecting the delivery health insurance, so the health law and the insurance law as well as the education law. But things like the managed care bill of rights where you have, you know, the right for an external appeal, all those things which are the consumer protections, mm-hmm, are critically important in New York, and those are through the insurance department.
Okay. And maybe if it's a matter that we don't want to seem to be blessing all of the components of the existing law, maybe what we can say is that these recommendations are with the backdrop of an understanding that there is an existing law and we make recommendations for changes when it's come up as necessary, something like that, right?
Right, sorry. A much better way to say what I was going to
say. I'll also say that in the behavioral world, behavioral health world, because the dimensions of risk are a little different. You know, that is, it's easy to keep people from not using enough service. You know, and if you make a service too generous, people will use too much of it. So the dynamics of risk are a little different. And so often the way this works is not a straight capitation per se, but a floor put on medical loss or services spend. With risk sharing between the plan and the, you know, and the entity, and with a fee paid for administration that's subject to, you know, incentives. Under those arrangements, the amount, you know, spent for the administrative thing is often quite a bit less than in the mainstream insurance world because risk is shared and the plan does not have to be at full risk for everything. So just That's an observation about how some of this stuff works. And so depending on what the arrangements are, if the state wanted to contract for less than full risk, it could pay probably less than 10 or 15%.
Yeah, I just want to add that 15% includes, to your point, you're absolutely right on target, that also includes the requirement that you put money in to, you know, the reserve, so that some of that is not admin, it's reserves, which are required under the law. If you have risk capped, you don't need the same level of reserve. So that's very positive.
Can I just, Mike, one quick point? We're getting emails from people asking who are listening in saying, is this on the web, this document?
Well, this was like, you know, finished at like 10 o'clock Friday night, and so it's not posted yet.
Okay.
It will be posted as soon as we can get it up.
Thanks.
John, a question on the second bullet. Would it be assumed is that actuarial assumptions would incorporate so epidemiological data that relates to physical health expenses where people are currently not, you know, the consequences of not getting appropriate behavioral health services?
No, because actuaries don't do that.
Don't. Okay, so how
this
do you...
This is a problem we had in getting parity passed. You know, the actuaries kept looking at fee-for-service and saying it's going to cost you all this money, yet every time, you know, parity was applied, it was done in a managed fashion, and the increases were minimal. But it took the actuaries 15 years to modify the arrangement. So they only drive in the rearview mirror. They don't drive looking forward.
So having said that, then, do we want to put any kind of a statement in there that basically talks about...
I think we'll get there later.
Yeah,
well,
okay.
Well, actually, look at... can you see where my cursor is? This is the last bullet on page 7. Savings on behavioral and physical health care attributable to improved care coordination of behavioral health populations should be tracked.
Yes, thank you. That's
okay.
Good.
Yeah.
Thank
okay.
you. Yep.
Good.
So
if they can be.
Yeah, right.
The point that Commissioner Hogan was making about a floor and expenditures, if you look at page 9, the last dark bullet, we put in there a defined floor on services spending in some, and talking about medical loss ratio, so we actually have that in there.
Okay, Phil, where are we trying to move on here?
We've
got 12 more.
Whenever we mention criminal justice, can we mention juvenile and criminal justice?
Great.
Yep.
So that it can be kept in the document.
Yep.
Totally.
Okay, so
okay.
Andy, contracting?
So these, again, all derive from conversations we've had or lists that we've put together before. First bullet, behavioral health managed care, and these should be tailored to local health delivery infrastructure and populations. That's a conversation we've had before. Yes?
Andy, just wanted to suggest this as a recommendation, that the thing you were talking about when you overseen like data and local behavioral health agencies, are you referencing the LGU, the county and the city? Is that what you're trying to do? That's what you recommend, the term that technically the LGU or the county of the city, and that's
Yep.
And then also on the last piece, their ONN/OASIS coordinated with DOH and consultation with the county.
Okay.
Okay, Adam.
Actually, Mike, do you want to discuss the second bullet? This is the state hospital.
Oh, yeah. So we've talked about this, and I think there was a agreement on it. One of the things that we'd like to do is carefully and appropriately over time introduce the population and the resources in state hospitals into something that can be managed by the managed care entity. So there's an opportunity for the managed care entity to, in a sense, pull people out for community services and to achieve reinvestment, in a sense, through the BHO. Because absent that, we don't have any way to get it done other than the annual appropriation process, which usually results in the dollars being lost.
Reinvestment of the state hospital dollars, you mean?
Yes. Repatriation of the people and reinvestment of the dollars.
Mike, thank you for putting that in.
Does that mean it's kind of like part of a capitation thing?
Well, we have to figure out the details of this, and it's complicated. But the notion is to do it on a phased-in basis as is appropriate. But we'd like to have a recommendation that provides for the authority to do it.
Is it assumed there's, by the language that hospitals work, something about ATCs, the whole...
No, we're just making an assumption about the state hospital.
Yeah, I was just going to interject. I think we need to clarify that point because the ATCs are very different from the inpatient OMH. So if we could just distinguish that.
Yeah.
We are managed already.
So that's what that one is. We're sort of okay with that principle. I mean, I wish we could define it in more detail, but it's pretty complicated. We just want to sort of establish the position there.
So next bullet is safe. Oh, I'm sorry, yeah.
I just was going to ask a question about safety net. Like, what happens to people who are served in a state-funded system now that don't have Medicaid?
Well, that's an issue that's got to be worked through. You know, I don't know what the answer to that is. We don't,
okay.
You know, what I'd like to do is to, you know, just myself personally, is to create a set of incentives that balance appropriate care. And right now the way it works is if you can get somebody in the state hospital, it doesn't cost anybody any money except the state, and they, you know, you can't get them in, and then they can't get out. It's different in the KID system. The KID system is much more dynamic. But we'd like to have incentives for people to be able to move when it's appropriate, and we'd like for the resources to appropriately move with them. And there ought to be, you know, what maybe isn't said in here is there ought to in perpetuity be whatever safety net is needed for, you know. Right. Right. People shouldn't be institutionalized for insurance reasons. Another part of it. Right.
So next bullet basically is that the benefits, whether behavioral health only or behavioral and physical health under a special needs plan, should be comprehensive. Some description of what comprehensive mean, references peers, and not some non-clinical services. The SNP benefit should include pharmacy, care coordination, care management, health home services. SNPs and BHOs should be required to do some coordination with local human services, social services, organizations, criminal justice, et cetera. Protocols should be developed where there are services outside of the Medicaid system. There should be some protocols for sort of directing how people in a managed care plan can access those services so that it is not, we don't just get to a first come, first serve, what's the relationship with a particular plan, that kind of a thing. But that if they're sort of common public benefits, there should be some protocols on how plans can access them for people.
Right, and can I go back to the previous bullet with SNPs and BHOs should be required to participate in coordination activities?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we had suggested something that was somewhat relative, and I don't see it in here, but it's under the contracting process, we had recommended that coordination with the county/city in terms of oversight of the system and monitoring access for gaps in mental health, substance abuse, and social support services in the region. Consistent with the planning cycle that's done at the local region, local level, and the county, city, you know, mental health commissioners, when we bring that together, and also the linkage at the local level with the social support to social services.
Right.
Is that a similar theme to what is in here, or?
Actually, I think that's kind of, well, in some ways, a combination of those two bullets, but maybe we can work,
yeah,
we can work
it's
on
a human services system. I just would feel more comfortable if it specifically identified the mental health commissioners as well.
Okay.
And that would have been one of the bullets that we had recommended. And
then the last bullet is, the next bullet is about care coordination and the need for managed care entities to have robust care coordination activities. You can read that or perhaps have. The next one is about the networks of providers that would be expected for plans or managed care entities to have, bad typo in there, collaborative, not collaborative, plan provider network partnerships. Sorry about that. But basically that there be a robust provider network, et cetera.
That goes to the heart of a fairly substantial discussion and debate going on in managed care in general, and one that we're engaged in discussing with the insurance with the health department as well. What's happening more and more in the field around the country is as there's a greater focus on outcomes and accountable care organizations and different kinds of delivery systems that are more integrated and more quality-oriented. What plans are doing around the country is making the network smaller but higher performing. And so the old idea of, you know, every willing provider, you know, is gone out the door. And in fact, what's selling in commercial insurance are more and more plans with smaller networks because they cost less. So while we can't take a position on that here, I understand that. Let's be careful that if we're talking about a robust network, we're also talking about quality and performance, because more is not always better. It could be worse. So we need to reserve the ability to look at, you know, the quality of those services, not just the quantity.
I have one other thing in this section, and it skips ahead as well, and that has to do with requirements or strong encouragement for health information exchange.
You get that.
I know you do, but I have to say the IT section is a little esoteric. I mean, I understood it, but I don't know that everybody will understand it. And I'm not so sure that it should stand sort of alone as a technical augment, but be incorporated into the draft. So when you talk here about policies and procedures to exchange information with, you want to talk about the exchange of information between and among psychiatrists and primary care docs, for instance, or social workers and doctors or whatever. It just seems to me that you might inject some of that where it's appropriate.
Also, about communication between physical and mental health.
That's what I meant, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I'm unclear about the relationship with the children's support and
So you will see that there's a placeholder in this. So this is a list of recommendations, and there is a placeholder for the children's report and recommendations within this. So in other words, it could be section G, or I don't remember exactly which section it actually is. So we'll incorporate it in. It does mean we'll have to do some work on getting the structures to work together.
And what happens if the recommendations are slightly different around the same kind of, if the adult or other recommendations are different than the kids' ones?
Are they directly, they conflict, or that we recommend one thing for adults and one thing for kids? That's no problem.
I'm not sure. I have to look at that.
Maybe we should work them through individually. It might be when we shuffle the decks. One shuffle is to take general principles out and upload them to the whole. The other shuffle is to look for those conflicts, and either we resolve it or we let the conflict stand and just say there's a different approach.
Right.
Okay.
Something real general, like family and caregiver involvement, is absolutely critical to this kid.
Next one you've seen before. This is a list of expected best practices in plans, and you can see it includes a defined floor on services spending, risk sharing between payer and plan, coordination with other with housing, other social supports, and all along up there.
Right.
Sorry, I'm skipping back to the last bullet.
I'm sorry, I really can't hear you.
Put your mic down there, Phil.
The bullet prior to this, I just didn't get there in time, on managed care entities should be required to have networks of providers,
yes,
et cetera. That bullet, that stands. Am I correct? As is?
Yeah.
Okay.
The one thing I might say, just to follow up on the comment made, is that we could add a clause that says that focus on the highest quality and performance, right? So you can put a
cover.
Right?
Okay, and then the last bullet in this section is about the use of standardized assessment and level of care protocols.
Wait, two more hands.
Just a quick comment. I know that we're supposed to be talking about things that there are gaps, but I just think this is terrific, so I wanted to say that.
Thank you.
And,
the
next comment is just sort of is a comment and not a change, and that is that on several of these, including the paragraph about benefits and some of the things in the last bullet, just to note that just recently the Coalition for Whole Health, which is the national coalition of really across the field of behavioral health, has developed recommendations for the federal essential health benefit package on what services should be in there.
Right.
And it relates to several of these bullets, and I'll make sure to get it to you. It just came out a few weeks ago. It's been endorsed by virtually all of the field, and it may be useful to reference or grab parts or whatever. But I'll send that along.
Great. Thank you.
This may be my own density in this, but we're talking about health homes on one side, which is kind of the integrated delivery system over here, and they're talking about taking over all of the care coordination and slots and money moving forward. And we're talking about a SNF and BHO over here having care coordinators. Don't we have to take, going back almost to the initial thing, that we need to take a stand somewhere as to we believe this to be true?
Mm-hmm. So I think, we include later on in here, and we weren't going to go over it, some of our health home recommendations.
Yeah.
The health home recommendations basically say, what's developed for health homes, which are at least in their funding stream inherently temporary, is meant to have to move into another form, and thus that form is managed care. And so some of these recommendations around care coordination and funding, that is assumed that comes from the health homes, and at the end of this period of health homes and before we get to risk-bearing managed care, there's a transition into the risk-bearing managed care.
So that's one of the reasons why you had the no cuts in year one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay.
So yeah.
Well, we can maybe be a little bit more, we can pull that together a little bit better. Next section is on eligibility for SNFs and BHO enrollment. So to be clear, this isn't eligibility for Medicaid, but who is in a BHO or special needs plan or IDS. First bullet basically says that SSI status for special needs plan, SSI status, I'm sorry.
Where are we?
Page 10.
Good. Okay.
We should get rid of this SSI status distinction that we currently use for who's wholly in a managed care plan and who's carved out of a managed care plan, and we should move to a clinical status and or utilization model.
So I'm thinking that this is probably one area where we take the kids' recommendation and, you know, import it here but have it stay distinct for children.
Right, something different.
What they said.
But just be careful that, you know, the plans get differential amounts depending upon whether someone's SSI or TANF. So if somebody happens not to be SSI but has this clinical need, there needs to be a way to support them if to follow that recommendation.
Right, which is...
You'd have to have some other kind of risk adjustment other than TANF, age, SSI.
Right.
Right? Okay.
And then the next bullet is just about including dual eligibles in this kind of delivery reform.
Right.
Good on that?
Yep.
Next, promotion of improved behavioral health care and primary care settings. This is the general recommendation about reviewing clinic licensing requirements.
Right.
Health information technology, and Pam, that's a good point about trying to maybe incorporate this into general standards.
So I just had one question
please,
here. You say here the elimination of barriers to participating in health information exchanges. Well, that really is, actually the major barrier is money. You see, that is a major barrier. I hate to be that way, but it's true. I mean, that's a barrier. So the question is,
what do we mean?
Do you, you know, you earlier on, I thought, I suggested that reinvestment could be used for IT. I told Adam about that. So I'm not sure what you meant by other barriers. I mean, there are a million, but what did you have in mind?
We talked this one, the information exchange and rules and different protocols between
right.
CEOs and maybe another one.
Right, but they all link to the statewide information network, which I think is pleasantly addressed in here. It should be okay.
So fair point. We should either clarify or...
Yeah, or say something about financial.
Or say something about financial.
Change the S barrier to a dollar sign. And then
Yeah.
All right.
Next one is just about the claims data and how it should be provided, claims and encounter data should be provided timely and shared across those who can use it appropriately and legally. And then we recommend a statewide health information exchange consent form that is a government obligation to sort of to standardize a consent form here. Any questions on that section?
Great.
Okay. Under performance metrics and evaluation, again, all well-discussed themes, generally that managed care entities should be held responsible for providing care, coordinating care, and for outcomes. That plan performance should be based on validated measures across a whole variety of domains that we lay out. That mainstream plans should be evaluated on a more robust set of behavioral health performance measures. They're quite limited so far.
So let me ask you a question about this. This, you know, I should have been paying more attention, because I just came back from, you know, 2 days in Washington. Working on this Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention. So I haven't had that side of my brain connected to this side of my brain. Here's what the best people doing this work say, and this is with respect to screening. And the recommendation is essentially that screening for common mental health problems, addictive disorders, and suicidality should be essentially universal. Is that okay with everybody? Now the way that some people are accomplishing this is through essentially a PHQ-9 or a modified version of that. At Henry Ford, they use a 9-item scale that is not just depression and SBIRT, but it's depression, anxiety, substance use problems, and one question about suicidality. And the suicide, you know, prevention people are telling me, the clinicians who do this research are saying, it's not adequate to just ask about these behavioral health problems and then come in and, you know. So I don't know what to do with this, because I'm in front of the cover here, but, you know, something about moving in that direction, without necessarily imposing a mandate that we can't impose right away. Are people comfortable with that?
Well, I mean, this is an issue that, you know, the New York Business Group on Health has worked on for years, and we've, by, you know, begging, pushing, stealing, cajoling, tried to expand the level of screening just in ordinary primary care for depression. And our plan, we're actually paying for it, which is, in my opinion, not the right way to go, but we are doing it out of desperation to get more providers to do it. But the truth is, that should be part of the practice of medicine. It's just like doing, you know, your blood pressure. This should be either PHQ or, you know, Q2 or 9. So anything we can do to get the expectation that the practice of medicine should not overlook depression, at least, and suicide, should be done.
Yep. And do you promote, like, one screening instrument?
There generally is one that everybody uses, right? With some.
There are a couple, three variants, but I think that, we don't have enough expertise to do that.
I mean, for example, if you're doing a history and physical on a patient as part of the ambulatory visit, you can't finish it unless you're asking about depression and whatever.
So taking a business group will see you the PHQ-9 credit with the standard.
Yeah. So I think that's really important, that conversation.
Maybe EG, or for example?
EG.
EG. Thinking about it.
Huh?
Okay, thanks.
A lot of the evidence points to the need not only to do the screening, but have effective structures and mechanisms to follow up the referral. And that's what the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendation on depression screening refers to that element also, and that's probably worth mentioning.
So Lloyd and I have been talking about this, and he's carrying the ball with our colleagues in the Department of Health. But if you read the Preventive Services Task Force recommendations, you know, closely or cynically, what it says is, if you got the resources around to treat depression, then you ought to screen for it. That's what it actually says. No, that ain't acceptable. So what we're working on is to sort of push the notion that it really is what Eileen said, that, you know, a framework like collaborative care needs to be the universal framework for primary care. So that maybe is, you know, that's sort of going out for different. We're working on that in other contexts.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Next, public reporting on Medicaid spending on behavioral health services over time. Again, same transparency, except it goes not only to year-by-year spending, but over time. Special issues on, so here are placeholders. Special issues on populations will incorporate recommendations from the uninsured group as discussed, same with children, same with peer services and engagement. And then we just move on to the health home recommendations that we had finalized previously.
Remembering that the children's health home conversation isn't anywhere yet.
We can make reference to that.
Mm-hmm. And that will be back in January, December.
Right.
We should absolutely, you know, so that the quality reporting should be transparent.
Exactly. And then so the health home recommendations, and then we just do a short list of topics that we sort of were raised but we considered outside of the charge. That's the role of block grants and forensic services, and then the appendices we had in mind.
Holy cow.
I know.
Good.
And it doesn't include an overview kind of narrative.
Right. So, Phil?
I'm
I'm sorry. I hope I'm not beating a dead horse, but can we return to one thing that I was concerned about earlier? And that was the bullet on page 9 that we modified in language, and Linda actually did an interesting language modifier that helped, I think, satisfy the spirit of what we were talking about. But I do believe that quality, standardized quality measures aren't developed yet. We don't have objective standardized measures of quality to determine, you know, which provider should be good and which one should be bad. So I would want some qualification in there that stated that, you know, that the provider, that the network of providers should be robust and should foster strong collaborations and so forth, but that, and that clearly there need to be quality and outcomes, measures, and other kinds of ways of determining that, but that those have not yet been developed. They are evolving, and there should be some reference to the that to that fact.
I have a problem with that.
Can I, and maybe just, I feel like a little bit out of the loop, so I just want to ask for me and others who might be in also where I am. Is this a matter of who chooses the adequacy of a provider network? And so who's in control of that? And I guess part of that question is what is the underlying managed care rules as it relates to the state's oversight in determining the adequacy
there,
of the
there are, there's a whole very formal process, and I'm going to, I'm not expert in it, but you have to submit your network for approval. And there are standards of access. I think it's the 30 minutes. Is this the 30 minutes?
Right, like their geographic access.
There's a whole set. So you can't just decide what you have as a network. Your network has to be approved. Your it has to meet certain standards set by the Department of Health. Around behavioral, the issue about quality indicators, there are certain HEDIS measures around behavioral. They're fairly primitive. That's
very few.
But
yes.
That's true. But this project we're talking about does not take effect for 2 or 3 years. I don't see any reason why we can't assume, and if you want to say it, that there will be more sufficient quality measures than we now have. But to make it all mushy so that we'll never get to it is unacceptable.
No, I wasn't trying to make it mushy nor unacceptable, but I also wanted to restrict the authority of the plans to say, you know, we'll go with 4 providers or these 6 providers, and that
they can't do that now, and so they won't be able to in
well,
the future.
On the
you have to have the access. No, even there, Phil.
Okay.
Maybe as a way to bridge these, is we should be saying that OASIS and OMA should promulgate comparable standards for network, should promulgate and apply comparable, you know, behavioral health standards for network adequacy.
I would live with that. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mike.
Yeah, no, we haven't, I just hadn't thought of that. That's a good point.
Now, when you're doing that, I think that there's going to be things, you know, well, you can do that in the city, and that's going to be, you're going to have one team, but when you get up in the North Country, certain areas, except New York, that's going to create, the standards are going to be very different somehow. I don't know how you address that. You know, just when you do it, you know, if you do it statewide, I think it's problematic.
And geographic consideration,
so they
would,
right.
I agree.
I mean, I think the way they do it in the mainstream is sort of the minimum is some geographic, you know, sort of access. And if you don't meet that first, everything else sort of, you first have to meet that. And
the upstate issue is a real problem.
Yeah.
But we shouldn't tackle it.
If you can't meet what the standard is, then you have to stand out
next. Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. Yeah. Absolutely. You're absolutely right. I mean, the other thing, upstate for children, there are areas where there are no child psychiatrists.
Right.
I mean, it's a huge problem.
Right.
So we do need to be cognizant of it.
I think some of this is going to emerge as we move into health homes. I mean, we're actually later this week, OMH and OASIS are talking to the health department about reviewing the letters of intent, and we're taking the position that for health homes that are going to have a high number of people with behavioral health enrolled, the two agencies, OMH and OASIS, need to really be involved in approval of the network.
Yes.
We agree.
Yes, definitely.
So just to come back again, no, we're not quite ready. Oh, so, Gail?
So I'm trying to figure out, are we supposed to
fit all of this onto these forms that the MRT wants?
Well,
I mean, is there a, do we have a presentation problem?
We're trying to figure this out, and I think my sense is that we will have a we have here with a lot of editing that's going to be done. We'll have a formal report that, you know, sort of will be posted as the subcommittee's report, and then I don't think we figured out precisely how to present it to the overall MRT. Except I think we're coming back to them and saying we've gotten together with a broad array of key stakeholders and taken your mandate and worked very hard to make it real and to flesh it out. And basically, you know, our report does that. And the question of what is going to be actionable on their part, you know, I'm not, you know, because they're really not an appropriating body. We're very concerned about, you know, the budget following this, but that's a separate deal. So I don't know exactly. So
can I just,
yeah.
I would hate to be in a situation where we left it to them to figure out which parts of this report become priority.
Well, that's the right, and that's part of the tension. So I think we've got a report that includes all of this. Then I don't think what we have figured out is, given that, and we'll give them the report, what else do we have to present to them? Do we want to take – I really like the way, frankly, that you laid
this
out.
Well, we sort of did it the idiot way, right? We sort of did ours for dummies because we didn't know what format to put it in, so we just did their format,
right,
assuming that it would fit. But I would like to just make a suggestion, although it's easy for me to say since I'm not going to write this, but I think that the full report has tremendous value. But I think it leaves too much discretion in the hands of people who are going to not understand it. And so it seems to me like it might be useful to think about the forms as an executive summary bullet list of things that are priorities that we would then be able to just pull out so that there's no walking away from it. Because it feels to me, I mean, I apologize because I wasn't at the last meeting, but some of this stuff is really like at 20,000 feet, and I just wouldn't want other people to decide for us.
Linda's nodding. So I think our answer to that is yes. So we will take the essence of it and distill it into specific recommendations for them and submit that along with the overall report.
Thank you.
Yes, Cindy?
Just a question. Are you going to email the staff to work with members?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how we're going to handle that. You know, I don't want to get into less detailed group editing, but you guys will have something, you know, before we present it. So, and we haven't figured out how to finesse that yet.
Part two of my question is, when do you want additional comments for? You know, certainly, we want to share this with our membership, at least a portion of this.
Yesterday.
I don't know how to
handle this. You know, I don't want to get into, going downtown and polling people about, you know, have you got any ideas that, you know, so. I think our commitment is to take everything that has been spoken here by consent and to include it and to give you all a copy of what we go live with, you know, sort of one, you know, before we go live with it.
Right. So maybe the thought of perhaps.
Yes.
I'm not sure I've gotten incorporated in, so I need to go back again and look at sort of what we've already submitted.
So I think right. So that, and I think that's a good parameter for everybody. So I think if everybody wants to reflect back on those things that we've discussed that maybe haven't been adequately addressed, and a couple points, you know, came up like that, then get that to the same thing as we said about to Gail. Get that to the co-chairs and or to Andy and Bob. So if it's something that dropped off the table that we should have got included, yes, by the end of next week. And then what I was going to say before about
the end of this week.
The end of this week, yes, sorry. In order for us to, and then I think the mode that we're in is then our work is temporarily done.
Just in hiatus.
In hiatus, yes. There will be a pregnant pause of the meetings of this group. Until when? Well, I don't know exactly when. I'm sort of thinking like before we go to procurement, assuming that we're going to procurement, which is what we're assuming. At some point in there, we're getting back together again for how are we doing, what else have we learned, how's this whole thing going, do we need to modify anything? Does that make sense to you?
I think what I'm thinking is that, and it's hard because I sort of have to take off my sort of my executive doer hat and put on my sort of advocate hat, is that in where the rubber is going to hit the road on our recommendations is how they're handled in the executive budget and then the legislative action following that. And it feels to me like we'll want to know, and so your best advice on how to know, you know, obviously how to help with the executive budget preparation and the likelihood of how we'll be treated, understanding that it's all super secret until the budget director hits go. And then post-release, I would hope that everybody here is part of the advocacy of sort of helping to inform and push it forward and maybe even address some of the things where we think it might be stronger in a way that is helpful to this process and doesn't and sort of recognizes that we have that role that's separate than, you know, than the executive role of actually executing what can be done. Does that make sense? And I don't know what that means in terms of when might be the best time to reconvene.
But it sounds like we reconvene about, you know, as soon as we can talk publicly about the budget, you know, sort of how do we do, you know.
How are we doing?
Yeah.
Before it.
Right. Right. So that would be, you know, some point in the middle of the winter. But that's when the timeline would be. And the other thing that's going to be going on, and we don't know exactly what the timeline will be, although I think it will be comparable, is when is the state prepared to go forward with this waiver? Because that's the other. There's the budget, and the language in the budget. But almost as critical for us is what's the waiver application going to say about our stuff? And, you know, so far the drafts have said nothing. That's probably about the same timetable.
So, Mike, isn't the final shoe dropping the RFPs that eventually go out at some point? And how do we get to see that what we've done has any meaning in the?
Well, that's what I was saying, but I think Linda has appropriately pulled it back to say. That's one time frame, but another is, you know, appropriation and waiver.
So I'm getting budget, waiver, RFP. Is
budget,
three.
Waiver, pre-RFP.
I'd
like
to add another point on that. Just to make sure I ask it, is that when the MRC reviews the report, they
I think all of us meet. We have, you know, we all meet, and I completely agree with you. I think that once we have our recommendations done, and once they've been formally submitted, I think all of us who do advocacy work will look at them and talk to people that we talk to. And I think to the extent that there's some advocacy that would seem to make some sense prior to the budget, would seem to me it would be if we could get on the same page about that, then we push. I think we did a very good job of coming together on the BHO conversation. And I think.
I think what we're saying is we're going to try to get the report done so it's ready to go to the MRT whenever their first meeting in October is. And it would be nice to see some of you there, not that everybody has to sort of come with placards or whatever. And, you know, I survived the Behavioral Health Subcommittee. So that's what we're going to try to do. We're going to try to get this revised and so that you can see it. On its way to the subcommittee on the 5th, and then, well, we hope that there's a positive conversation about it there.
The MRT meeting?
I think this one it is, yes. Full MRT. So that's like, you know, that's stage number two. Then stage number three is as soon as that we can talk about this in the context of the budget, there's another opportunity for conversation, which is about the same time. Maybe we can have a, you know, a conversation about a draft of an 1115 waiver narrative. Does that include our things or not? That's like stage two. And then stage three is pre-solicitation for, you know, for BHOs/SNPs. I think that's the mode we're in.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, so Pam?
So maybe early January, or sometime in January.
Yes.
Before we're sort of in the throes of it. Would be great to get some.
Yeah, we're in the throes of it the second after
sure
it starts, but yes.
I know. Well,
right about at the earliest moment.
Yes. At the earliest.
Which would be mid, you know, the Ides of January.
Okay.
So.
So the next meeting of the big MRT is on October 5th.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
In Albany, Empire State Plaza,
1 to 11:30.
And then my understanding is that
there'll be successive meetings. I was asking Medicaid director about this, and he gave me the impression that we would October 5th meeting, we hear the general presentation, and then there'd be several other meetings where these eight groups maybe they'd hear from four groups, and then four groups in more detail. The impression I got. In November and December.
Right.
Just quickly, I just want to make sure. So when we review this, we get suggestions or questions or anything back to you by the end of next week. Is there
this
any
week.
This week.
I'm sorry. Right. End of this week. Will there be another opportunity for us to even, like, talk a conference call, or would you prefer? I understand the need to get this.
I think if we need to, we would. But my bet is that. Folks might have a little here or there. My expectation that something huge and new and, you know, controversial and in need of big discussion hopefully won't appear.
Okay.
But if it does,
okay.
We'll do it, right? You know, that's supposed, yeah.
Okay. I think also, you know, there's a value in this group of us getting together.
Agreed.
I'm glad to know that we'll be meeting again at the end of January and others and other times, and maybe we can talk up more and think forward about having
I will say, as Pam is getting up to go, but I will say that's all right. That's totally cool. The participation in this over the summer has just been extraordinary. So I really want to appreciate you all being here. Many of you have signed up for additional duties as required. The staff have not had a moment to sleep.
I think the staff did. I think you all did a fabulous job.
So one of the things that it just occurs to me that's been swirling around, but we're doing this interim BHO thing that, you know, but we weren't supposed to say anything about it because the governor's office was going to do a press release, and there's been consideration for 2 weeks about whether they would do a press release, and I think, you know, as of today, probably they're not. I think you're going to send out a...
It's already been sent out.
Right. But so in case anybody didn't read it, we can tell you how that ended up, you know, if anybody's not paying attention. So I think it was a very good process that resulted in a very good set of organizations with whom we are now proceeding to have, you know, final negotiations leading to a contract. So we don't have contracts yet, but we've selected people to negotiate. Now, I'll sort of do this from memory. So, starting with the western part of the state, in the west, we're negotiating with the Western Care Coordination, you know, group, committee, organization, corporation, whatever it is, which is working in conjunction with Beacon. In central New York, we're going to be negotiating with Magellan. In the Hudson River Group with the Community Care Behavioral Health Group out of Pittsburgh. In New York City with Optum. And on Long Island, I'll sort of jump ahead here a little bit, but this Richards Group at Value Options is working collaboratively with the LIJ network to see if it's possible for them to develop a partnership approach just suffice it to say there were two strong proposals that complemented each other, and so the question was whether they can come together. So we're not going to presume that they can. They're having conversations. Richard has told us that those conversations are going well, so you know we don't know how that will play out. But I think it's a very good outcome. So assuming that the contract negotiations go well, and it's going to be complex and difficult, but sort of we're going to have somewhere involved in the state, you know, sort of all the leading national players. We're going to have several different alternatives, like the participation of a major network on Long Island with one of the major national players, and a county-sponsored group on the other hand. So it's, you know, the only major option that didn't emerge from this was a mainstream health plan, and there weren't many proposals. There was one proposal, but it didn't quite make it. But it's a very strong group of organizations with which we're negotiating. So nice to be able to say that that's going forward pretty well. And so, Abigail?
I just wanted to say thank you for making this process actually end on time with a product, because it's really unusual. So for the leadership of the work group and for the membership, it's a really big step forward from a public policy standpoint. So thank you for being so efficient.
Well, of course, your group did it, Gail, in half the time. So we'll All right. Thanks, everybody. Well done. We'll see you around the quad.
I think they've done a great work.
Thank you.
Yeah.